Hi, I'm Rocky Lotka. Welcome to the next session, I think right before lunch. That's a great place to be. Everybody's awake because we're all anticipating food. I'm the author of a number of books on developing software with Microsoft Technologies. And one of the things that's kind of been a consistent theme of a lot of the things that I've written and the techniques that I've used are geared around the idea that the platforms and UI technologies and data technologies that we use continue to change. There's really nothing stable. There's no island of stability that lasts very long. And so then the question becomes, at least from our, the people that pay us, our business sponsors, how is it then that we can build some software that will last us at least 5 years, maybe 10? Right? I mean, if we're going to invest a huge amount of money building some software package or product for our organization, how do we get that money back? Right? We're not going to get it back in a year or 2 years. And therefore, we have to build something that one way or another is going to last over a long period of time. So that's from the business side of things. Of course, then we look at it and we're like, yeah, so in a five-year window, who here thinks that XAML is going to be around in 5 years? Who thinks it's going to be the dominant technology that Microsoft is talking about in 5 years? Boy, you guys are confident. I mean, I love XAML. Don't get me wrong. I absolutely adore Silverlight. And yet, 5 years from now, somebody at Microsoft will have become bored and we'll have created something else, and they'll be out here going, hey, look at my cool thing, right? And we'll be talking about something else, right? HTML5, on the other hand, 5 years from now, will be halfway to becoming a standard, so we'll probably still be using that. The point being that if we're going to build software that's going to last through time, we have to be able to adapt that software, which means that we have to have some way of reusing at least some of our software assets, primarily code, but other things as well, as the platforms change. It's an interesting challenge. Now, even if you're in the camp that says, oh, yeah, we've reached the end, we're pretty stable now, right? We're going to get to use XAML and HTML5 for the foreseeable future, so we're set, baby. Even if you believe that to be true, the situation is still somewhat bleak. Even if you're a pure .NET developer, there are interesting challenges because you might write code that needs to run on Windows Server, on Windows Azure, and they're pretty similar but not the same, right? And Windows clients using Windows Forms or WPF, and Silverlight, and now Windows Phone. And if you're stretching things, you might be using MonoTouch and MonoDroid, which are kind of .NET. So then you're looking at this situation where you actually have multiple platforms, multiple UIs, multiple constraints, and ideally we're going to write at least some common code that can support my Windows user interface and my phone user interface and maybe some XML service interface. Now, wouldn't that be nice? I mean, really, in a sense, We've got a head start in that we've got one development platform, right? At least we're generally using .NET, Visual Studio, Expression Blend. So we've got some common set of tools and languages, but it's not a panacea. I mean, what we really want, I think, is to be able to say, well, I've got a database that supports my business, and I would like to have access to and use that database for all of my different interfaces, regardless of platform. And I'd like to be able to construct some data access code, whether I'm using ADO.NET or datasets or the entity framework or whatever makes you happy, and I would like to have that be consistent. And I would like to write some business logic. To me, this is an often overlooked little teeny aspect of applications. Everybody talks about, oh, the data. If I lose my database, I'm done. Right? And the database is the jewel of our organization. Well, there's truth to that, right? I mean, certainly, if I took away your database, you would be very sad. Almost certainly, right? On the other hand, if I took away everything else, and all of your computers, all your applications, everything else, and just gave you a database server with nothing else, how useful would that be? Right, with no applications, no business logic, no reporting, no context for the data, data is almost useless. And so, to me, the jewels of your organization are the database and your business logic. And so, to me, being able to create business logic that will be around for many, many years is just as important as creating a database that will be around for many, many years. There are other things as we go forward, right? You might say, well, but we invested tens of thousands of dollars in an advertising firm so that they would give us some graphic images of what we would like our website to look like. And now we're going to spend tens of thousands of dollars having developers translate Photoshop into reality. Right? No? Seriously? Nobody does this? I mean, this is my experience, right? I work for a consulting company, right? So we come in and are often given Photoshop things that no developer could actually create, but designers could imagine. And then we're asked to make them come alive. It's fun. Anyway, so there's some possibility of reusing some of those assets, although you've got to recognize in today's world, I think, that there's a big difference between a 27-inch computer monitor and a 3-inch phone and an 8-inch tablet or slate or pad or whatever you've got. And so there's some very, very, very real differences in these form factors. And yet, increasingly, when I'm talking to different organizations, things like phones or slate pad-type computers, almost everybody's talking about this, is what parts of our organization, what parts of our application can fit on an 8-inch screen? And so it's an interesting thing. So whether you can bring artwork, styles, layouts, user experiences, I think is an interesting question. Certainly, build processes, source control management, a lot of these things we would like to be consistent. If we've got build servers, we want them to run our phone tests just as much as we would like them to run our .NET testing. And then there's soft things, training content and so forth, that also, and we might not care, right? Most of us are developers. But certainly from a high-level picture, this is a big deal. Oop, now I went too far. We also would like to leverage each platform. Right? So on one hand, you can take what I'm talking about and say, I've got the answer. I've got the answer. Right? In a sense, the lowest common denominator for the Microsoft world right now is the Windows Phone. It's the smallest screen. It's the essentially oldest version of .NET because it's more or less Silverlight 3. Right? So if I build everything to work on the phone, with very little effort, it'll work on Silverlight and probably in WPF. I'll just build everything for the phone. Well, I mean, and what I'm getting at is actually a broader theme of least common denominator. Right? As soon as anybody gives a talk like I'm giving, the first thing that people think of is, oh, yeah, he's just going to go with least common denominator, and we never want to do that. We being whoever, right? We don't. If I'm going to build something for WPF, I want it to exploit everything that WPF can do. When my text box goes into error, I want it to do some three-dimensional spinning around, jumping up and down thing, because WPF can do that. And the fact that the phone can't should not restrict the fact that I could create God's worst ever nightmare of a UI in WPF. Right. But I mean, in seriousness, we do want to exploit the capabilities of each platform, right? I mean, this is true. So then the question becomes, how do I get reuse without crippling, say, WPF in order to support the web or vice versa or something along that line? It's an interesting challenge to be sure. So to make this happen, of course, what we end up is this interesting thing where Well, let me back up. I have a little rant I have just enough time to fit in my little rant. See, I spent much of my career, and you know, I see a fair number of people in my age group, right? So we're in the 20-plus years in the industry, right? And I spent much of my career pursuing reuse. I pursued reuse in Fortran by trying to come up with reusable procedures. That was a nightmare. And pursued reusable components in the COM era. That was DLL hell, right? And then reusable objects and reusable this's and that's. But it's all reuse, reuse, reuse. Everybody wants to reuse. And in fact, the title of my talk has the word reuse in it, which makes me sad. It was my title. Don't feel bad for me. Why does that make me sad? Well, it turns out that this fixation on reuse is not healthy for any of us. It turns out that reuse is not a goal. We just think it is. We've been deluded into thinking that we all want reuse. What we really want is cheaper software. Right? Software that's quicker to build, easier to maintain, and therefore costs less to create, and more importantly, costs less to keep running over a 5 or 10 year period of time. That's what we really want. And then we kind of skip past that and said, oh, well, the way to get that is reuse, because that'll reduce the amount of code. The problem with reuse, how many people have seen or are Batman fans? At least seen the Batman movies. I'm actually both. I'm a deeply, you know, big Batman guy. So one of the villains, of course, in the latest movie is Two-Face, the guy that has the coin that's burned on one side and shiny on the other side. And of course, the thing about Two-Face is that he's always flipping the coin to decide people's fates. Well, that coin represents reuse. The shiny silver side of that coin, if it lands shiny side up, you're like, woohoo! Right? This is great. The thing is, you can't get reuse without the worst ultimate evil on the planet, which is coupling. Right? And in fact, earlier in the previous talk, you heard about coupling, and it'll continue through the entire week, is how do we avoid coupling? Well, you can't have reuse without coupling. They just come together, baby. Right? And so while reuse seems like a goal, it turns out that actually it's something that's desirable as a means to getting lower cost software, but only if you can get it without causing too much coupling. And so when we talk about reuse across platforms, this is just as important as anywhere else, is how do I get some level of reuse without causing too much coupling? And of course, there's this old axiom in computer science, right? When faced with any really difficult challenge, with the intractable problem, what is the one guaranteed solution to any hard problem?
Another level of abstraction.
To which the reply is, well, eventually I'll have too many levels of abstraction and it will become really complicated. And what's the answer to any really complex problem? Wait, one more layer of abstraction. Hey, be quiet, David. You're not helping. But that's all a joke. Anyway, the point being, abstraction is good in terms of reducing coupling. Dependency injection, factories, and all these different patterns that exist. Most of them are geared one way or another toward abstracting some complicated problem. The real trick here, and in this regard, I agree with David, is that you have to be careful that if you adopt way too much abstraction, you literally end up with something where nobody can look at your code and understand what it's doing. And if that's true of a senior person, right? If we assume all of us generally are here because we love patterns and we love architecture, right? We love doing things the right way, we can create software that normal developers can't comprehend. Now, as a consulting company, I work with, you know, I mean, my job is to work with those normal people all the time. Right? I mean, almost every organization that I ever go into has a whole bunch of normal developers and then one or two superstars who are creating stuff the rest of them don't understand.
This is the normal organizational structure of an IT group, at least in my observation. And that's bad. I believe that's fundamentally horrible. And so if you are one of those superstars, and I suspect most of us are within our organizations, your job is, in fact, to do what you're doing, which is to come up with solutions to the really hard problem. And your job is to make sure that your abstractions are comprehensible and usable by normal developers. And I don't just mean your development team, because you might say, oh, yes, but my development team, we hire above the average. Right? And I've heard that, too. Right? And that may or may not be true. I mean, whatever, we could debate that. But let's just grant you that your development team is above the average. How about your maintenance staff? You know, the guys that are going to keep the software running for the next 5 or 8 years. Are they above average? Or are they the people that you just hired out of college? Because I can tell you that most organizations just hire people out of college, throw them at the software and say, here, keep it running. And your beautiful work of art, assuming you manage to pull that off, will rapidly become a rat's nest over a period of 3, 4, 5 years. Right? Because you're not there. And you've created something that normal people can't comprehend. So this is a big deal in my mind. So, to solve this problem, choose carefully what you're going to abstract. Things like dependency injection or IOC, great techniques. I've walked into organizations where they have it everywhere, where literally everything is abstracted. And see, some people think that's great. I think it's called job security because normal people can't comprehend this stuff. Right? Usually, what happens shortly thereafter is that people get confused and start creating multiple containers because they can't figure out how to get at anything. And a colleague of mine is in the middle of one of these projects right now trying to rescue it because our customer had spent about 1.5 years building the software, and I think that they counted 12 different cases where they're creating different IOC containers. And it's because some developer had to solve a problem. They were told they had to use an IOC container. They couldn't find one, so they just made one. Now, is this useful? I think not. Is this typical? I think so. Right? So choose your abstractions carefully. Don't just abstract for the fun of it. Abstract because you actually honestly think that you're going to swap out an implementation. Right? Seriously, if you're never going to swap out the implementation, adding the abstraction did nothing except add complexity and cost. Right? Try to favor normal coding practices, whatever that means. Right? I mean, in my mind, it means that the less stuff I have to learn, the less frameworks I have to conform to or adapt to or figure out, the less odd syntax I have to use, the better. Conversely, if you say, you know what, we've got this framework that uses, let's say, lambdas extensively, right? That's fine. Most people think that's odd syntax, right? Most people are going to look at code that's lambda within lambda within lambda, and they're going to go, whoa, what the heck's this thing, right? Well, if you're going to go down that road, then you have to assume a training burden. You have to. When you hire those people to do your maintenance right out of college, you're going to have to teach them how to deal with multi-nested lambdas, if that's the route that you took. If you're going to go with a dependency injection framework and everything's running through this container, you're going to have to assume the burden of training everybody on how you did that. Now, very early in my career, well, okay, to be honest, before my career, because this was a independent study thing I did in the university, I worked on a package called Apple 6. It was written in Fortran on a Prime mini computer, and it analyzed Landsat satellite data, which back at that point in time was kind of a big deal. Now we pull up satellite data from Google, right? And it's, times have changed. But at that time, it was a big deal, and they wanted to have it run on a VAX. Because the Prime clearly was fading and the DEC VAX was ascendant at that point in time, which for some of you tells you how long ago this was. The people that wrote Apple 6 or Apple V, I suppose, were really quite smart. They had abstracted the entire operating system. Think about this, right? Everything that dealt with file systems, with user interface, or well, drawing stuff on a terminal, basically anything that they could identify that was prime specific, that wasn't part of core Fortran, they created an abstraction layer, which meant that their abstraction layer was roughly as big as the application itself. And because they were very smart people and they were all deeply immersed in the prime computer, they didn't document any of it because, of course, everybody understands this stuff. It's obvious on the surface, right? I would argue that they abstracted too far, or at least at too low of a level, and the fact that they didn't document it was seriously problematic for us. Because we were looking at this, trying to get it to even compile on a VAX, and it wouldn't, of course, because their entire abstraction layer was wrong. But the Prime has certain operating system constructs that the VAX doesn't have. The VAX has certain operating system constructs that the Prime didn't have. And so now we're reading through their Fortran, trying to decipher concepts that we don't even have. Right? I mean, I don't know if this ever was ported. That's why the question mark's on the slide. Right, I was involved for a period of, I think, 6 months, and we made some progress. But what I learned out of this is that abstracting at the operating system level is not smart. It's too low level. So when you're going to abstract, you need to abstract, I think, at a higher level, at a conceptual level. So instead of abstracting the concept of a file I/O operation, you should abstract the concept of a file. Now, .NET actually does this pretty well. If you look, you know, there's a lot of abstractions in .NET itself, in the base class library, that abstracts Windows. And the reason I say that they do this pretty well is because in most cases what we see is that Mono is able to do it on Unix. And with Mono Touch and Mono Droid, they've been able to port .NET onto completely not Windows platforms, which speaks well to the people that design .NET in terms of maintaining this reasonably high level of abstraction. Along with this, I think, later in my career, in the days of COM, you know, we all tried to get abstraction and reuse out of components, right? The problem that we fell into, ultimately, is known affectionately as DLL hell, which is not so affectionate, right? And so the thing is that components are not an appropriate level of reuse either. So trying to abstract at the operating system level is not good. Trying to abstract at a component level is not good, primarily because components get merged together. Or how to say this better? When you sit down to build an application, you are taking components and mixing and matching and making them talk to each other, right? And ultimately, this is what we do. So if those components are versioning independently, and if they come from different vendors with different visions of how things should work, the components that you pick today might not work 2 years from now. Literally just might not work anymore. Maybe the company went out of business. Or maybe they still work, but they won't work for you, because the vendor that wrote that component went off, you know, that way into left field. And then they might think they're right, and maybe they are right, but they no longer fit with what you're trying to do. So I think that you have to come up with some higher level vision of a framework that transcends some of these ideas. And in fact, the question then is, what is a framework? In my mind, and this is my definition of these things, but it's the definition that I use when I'm trying to solve these problems, is that a framework is a codification of an architecture. I mean, architecture, and I'll talk about architecture in a second, but architecture is fundamentally some big picture thing, right? And many organizations that I've seen have architect groups. And those architect groups often are very heavily focused on doing things like writing documents. How many developers do you think read those documents? That would be zero, because the developers have real work to do. And honestly, if I was going to read a document about how to do MVVM, I would go get one from MSDN, where experts wrote it, before I would get one from my company, because Bob upstairs, you know, I know Bob. He's not that good. I mean, this is the reality. So architect groups that actually end up having a real impact do two things beyond writing documents, or maybe instead of writing documents. They do extensive training and continual training, and they create frameworks. They actually create tools that make developers' lives easier. Right? Developers won't read a document, but if you give them a framework that saves them time and effort, and you give them the training so they understand how to use it, right? Developers are like water. They follow the path of least resistance. So then, what's an architecture? Well, architecture is a big word, and it's used across all sorts of different places. And inside of Magenic, we constantly have debates about what's an architecture. To me, though, an architecture is something that transcends specific designs, and it transcends any specific application. And people say, but no, I have to have an architecture for my application. In my mind, that's a design. But you can call it an application architecture, I guess, right? Whatever. Certainly, I'm not talking here about enterprise architecture, because that's fluffy, right? People that want to retire go get that kind of job, and then they can just do PowerPoint. That's wonderful. But what I'm talking about is a tactical architecture, but one that applies across your applications, that describes something tangible, but not specific to any given particular application. So when we're thinking about an architecture and a framework, especially when we think about platform interoperability, we have to think about where are the points of complexity. Generally speaking, the points of complexity are always at the interface. Now, this might be the actual interface, like the man-machine user interface, but what I'm really talking about is something much broader in concept. Right? I can create a module of code that inside the module of code is really quite self-contained, simple, easy, right? I mean, you often see that in demos. Well, we'll pick an example problem, but it's a small enough one that we can show it to you in an hour. Well, it's a trivial problem, right? It's the limit of being a speaker. But on the other hand, this is true of an awful lot of software, in that we come up with bits of software that internally are very simple and consistent and very clean, very elegant. And as soon as they have to talk to other bits of software, that's where things get really complicated. I can create for you the most beautiful JSON service on the planet. As long as nobody calls it, it'll stay perfect. Right? As soon as people start talking to it, then they impose extra requirements, and I have to tweak it and change it, and right? The real world hits us. And it's all at the point of interface. And this is important, because this is the area, then, that you should focus your attention if you're trying to build software that can stand the test of time, is how do I make my interface layers or interface points abstract? I'm honestly far less concerned with coming up with a way of making my discount calculator absolutely gorgeous. I mean, I hope it's a good discount calculator module, but I'm much more concerned with coming up with an abstract way to interact with it, so that if I switch from an N-tier model to a two-tier or to an SOA model, that I don't have to completely scrap it just because of my architectural change. Does that make sense? So when I think about applications, this is the architecture that I use. If I'm building a service has an XML or JSON interface. It has some code behind that interface that's running it, the kind of controller or whatever pattern you're using. Behind that, I have some sort of business logic. Hopefully, at least in my view, these are business objects. But you might use workflows. You might use function libraries, whatever. Right? Somewhere I've got some business logic. Behind that yet, I've got some abstract way of talking to my database, and then I have the data store itself. This particular way of thinking about software has evolved, right? I mean, like most people, I started out with the three-tier or three-layer presentation business data. Well, that's fine, but it doesn't match today's world. I mean, it just fundamentally doesn't match today's world. Today, the interface is often tangibly separate, like it's running in a browser, whereas my interface control code is running on a web server. So if I'm going to talk about them in an architectural sense, I obviously have to delineate between two parts of the presentation. Right. Now, following this train of thought, you can end up with this kind of a picture. And in fact, this is really where I'm going to go as I continue to talk, is wouldn't it be nice if, from at least from the business layer down, I had complete consistency? And to me, this is a great picture because of all of the technologies that we change, that we deal with today, it's the presentation layer that changes fastest. You know, 15 years ago, that was not true. 15 years ago, it was all about databases changing. Right? ODBC took a decade to completely renovate the data access or the database world. Oops, I lost my watch. I don't have time for that rant. Trust me, ODBC turned the world upside down. With any luck, OData is going to turn the world upside down again. Right? That's what I'm cheering for. But be that as it may, we went through a period of maybe 10 years where the database in and of itself was not a reliable thing. Where your CEO or CTO or CIO or whoever was in charge went golfing with somebody, some salesperson from Oracle and came back and said, we're switching. Right? Well, that doesn't happen so often anymore. Right? The database world has stabilized to a very large degree, and companies generally don't switch on a whim like they used to do. But the UI technologies are changing like crazy. Right? Whatever we think we know about UI today, odds are 2 to 4 years from now, it'll be somewhat different. And so whatever we do, we have to assume, I think, that the presentation layer technologies are in flux, and we have to protect everything else. So another example, and of course this one is near and dear to my heart, is the CSLA.NET framework, because this is the outgrowth of a lot of the books that I've written over the past several years. And the idea behind CSLA is to help you build that business layer so that you can reuse it across different interface technologies and these days even across different platforms. I mean, different .NET platforms, right? .NET, Silverlight, and so forth. But there have been some interesting points of change that have certainly had major impact on the way that CSLA works. As much as I would love to say that people that wrote business object code using CSLA in, let's say, 2003 are still able to use that today on Silverlight, that's not true. Which, in my mind, goes to show that no matter how much you focus on this stuff, because I focus on this a lot, it's not always possible to see what's coming in 5 years, as much as you try, right? And so when generics showed up, for example, the fundamental change that generics brought at a language and runtime level was so dramatic that essentially no code carried forward. Right? I mean, whatever collection types you used to have all of a sudden become generic collection types. At least if you want to use the new features and get the benefits, your code is directly impacted. .NET 3 wasn't so bad, right? WPF, WCF. However, WPF did some nasty things, like redefining the way that equals works, which is a subtle deal. But if you go look out on the web, do some Googling with Bing, you will discover that there is this consistent issue where people used to override the equals method in order to come up with a kind of a more abstract level of equality, like customer one, that object is equal to customer one, even if they're different instances and even if some other properties are different. I'm saying that if I have an object called customer and its number ID is one, I think they're the same. If you do that in WPF, it won't work. Like, literally, WPF will break. Things like sorting in lists and even editing lists just stop working the way that you think they should, and you end up with unworkable code. So they redefined equals. Well, that had a pretty dramatic impact on CSLA because I was using the concept of logical equality and basically had to go through the framework and break everybody using CSLA by saying, yeah, you know, there is no such thing anymore. There's reference equality or nothing, because that's what WPF says. I'll get into some binding issues in a minute, because those are even more interesting. Silverlight shows up. Silverlight brought with it some interesting challenges around both being a subset of .NET, but I think more importantly around things like serialization, some data binding changes, and so forth. And so trying to be able to have code that runs on .NET and the exact same code runs on Silverlight is an interesting challenge. And it took several months of work to manage to pull that off, including ultimately I had to write my own serializer because Silverlight doesn't have the ones from .NET. A binary formatter or net data contract serializer don't exist on Silverlight. Can't exist, in fact, because Silverlight doesn't allow the kind of reflection that those formatters require. So we ended up having to come up with, and I'll talk about this too in a second. Silverlight 4 added some interesting things because Silverlight 4, in some sense, is a subset of WPF, right? It's also a superset. It actually does more than WPF does in certain cases and less in others. And so this mismatch between platform capability or between technology capability becomes really interesting if you want to share code. And of course, then we get to what I'm working on at the moment, which is WP7, Windows Phone 7. Wouldn't it be cool, so goes my train of thought, if my business logic that's running on .NET and on Silverlight could also run on the phone without change? Wouldn't that be great? And that I'm not quite there yet. Right? And the phone offers its own set of challenges. So here's some areas that I'm going to talk about just very quickly in the time that I have left. Some ideas around a presentation framework, or at least abstraction, that can get you across some technologies. Business logic and how you might abstract some of those are issues that you have to address, at least. Some data access abstraction. And then finally, some level of common unit testing. Because whether you go whole hog with the TDD, and apparently I'm an evil person because I don't, or you just are committed to doing testing, in which case I think I'm a fine person because I am, you have to do testing. So first, talking about UI abstractions. So there are a lot of UI patterns out there. I call these the M family of patterns, right? Because they all have models in them. MVC, MVP, MVVM, M this, M that, M the other thing, whatever. Patterns are great. I love patterns. The problem with patterns, especially some of these bigger ones like MVC or MVVM, is you can't do them without a framework. Cannot. Well, maybe you can, but your development staff can't. Right? I keep walking, because MVVM is such a big deal for both Silverlight and WPF, keep walking into organizations and they're assuming that they can sit down and create models, views, and view models, and it'll just work. And it won't. Right? It's not the same. If you sit down with ASP MVC, you really can create models, controllers, and views, and it does work. Why? Because there's this framework, right? There's this whole huge amount of plumbing that routes calls into the controller and helps the controller create the right view and renders the view or doesn't at test time, right? All these things that have to happen. No such framework exists out of the box for MVVM. And yet people just assume, well, it came from Microsoft. Microsoft says MVVM is good, therefore it must all be there. And of course it's not. So you have to come up with some sort of framework or acquire one. Right? That's okay, and I think probably most of us recognize this, but an awful lot of people don't, which is pretty scary. So there are some tactical issues to deal with when we think about building any sort of UI support, whether that's your framework or it's your model or actually usually a combination of both. Data binding in and of itself is a great tool because it provides a defined abstraction layer between the view and whatever you're binding to, whether that's your model or your view model. Right? We love it. I do. Right? Data binding is great. I've been pushing on the guys in the various product teams to improve data binding for many, 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 many years. And especially when we look at WPF, Silverlight, Windows Phone, and then for that matter, ASP MVC, there are really good binding schemes. What's sad is they're not all the same. How many people have Windows Forms applications in their organization? Few. How many of you are looking at WPF or Silverlight? It'd be everybody. So this is important to you at least, and that is that Windows Forms treats property change differently than WPF. And if you've optimized the way that you use property changed to make Windows Forms work well, your code will not work in WPF. Conversely, if you use the property changed event the way that you should use it in WPF, your code will work in Windows Forms, but you might have performance issues. Because it'll raise way too many events and it'll cause data binding to refresh many, many times more than it needs to. Now, ideally, what you would have is some situation where your framework, either at the business layer, the view model layer, or the presentation layer, abstracts this so you don't have to mess with it. Right? So, for example, see if my... Hello. There we go. Here's some code. I actually have this in my PowerPoint probably, but it doesn't matter. Here's some code that declares a property from, let's say, 4 years ago using CSLA. And there's a whole bunch of goo in here that's all nasty. I think I had my abstraction levels wrong. But the thing in particular that I want to call to your attention is that in the setter, I'm calling property has changed. And property has changed raises the property changed event along with a couple other things that it does. And so that may be fine, but it turns out that it's not a good level of abstraction because it doesn't allow this kind of control so that I can optimize Windows Forms versus WPF, for example. And so if we look at the same kind of code today, I've got a different level of abstraction. You can see some fun code that I'll talk about in a second around the phone here. But now, instead of any sort of explicit dealing with, let me switch back just for a second, right? Let's look at this code. I'm checking authorization. Is the user allowed to change the property? Is the property null? Because Windows Forms doesn't like null values. So you de-null things. But not for WPF, because it doesn't care. Then did I actually get a new value? And then property changed, which actually runs business rules and marks the object as having changed, because these are self-tracking entities, and raises property changed. And so you end up writing all of this code. And in order to avoid string literal issues, right, because can write property, how do you think that works? Really, it's can write property name, because this is the name property. Well, I went to a lot of work to figure out how to use various compiler runtime magic to find out that we're in the name property, and then discovered that there was a compiler optimization called inlining that would break that technique. So in order to make the code work, let's prevent the compiler from doing inlining. I'm critiquing my own code. Right? This was not ideal. It turned out to be really not ideal when .NET 64 jitters started coming out and have yet another optimization that there's no attribute to suppress. At which point, this just quit working. Right? So there's a whole bunch of things. Too much code. Not enough abstraction, The poor developer has to understand authorization, did the property change, all this stuff. There's just way too many things. And you might look at this and go, yeah, but that code's not that complicated. I can train my developers. But here's something that I think is really critical. There's two types of training. There's how do you do the code, and there's all of the concepts necessary to understand the code you wrote. I call this conceptual surface area. And I think this is just a really big deal in that when you are coming up with layers of abstraction, you have to minimize the conceptual surface area. If you want to use dependency injection, that's great. Does everybody have to understand dependency injection? I hope not. Right? So you want to use remoting or WCF. Does everybody have to become intimately familiar with WCF or remoting? I hope not. I mean, not all of my developers are actually that good. Actually, hopefully at Magenic they are, but you know, who knows, right? But honestly, in most companies, if you were to say everybody here has to be a WCF expert in order to write a simple CRUD application, honestly, we're building a doghouse, to use the keynote analogy. Right? Why do I have to understand rocket science level network technologies in order to build a doghouse? And yet, by corporate mandate, we're all three-tier. In my view, you should abstract WCF, make it disappear into the framework. You should abstract things like dependency injection, make them use them, but make them disappear. Right? And so then you can end up with things like this, where all of my getters and setters look the same. Now, the fact that set property, to describe it, in fact, is a full-page flowchart, because set property does a whole bunch of really cool stuff that's different on Windows Forms than it is from WPF. Do I care? Right? As the author of a business application, what I care about is that I'm setting a property and it works. And if I bind this object to a Windows form or to a WPF form or to a Windows phone UI, it just works. Right? And so let me clean this up just to make this a little tidier. So if we look at what I'm doing in order to make this happen, and you know, these are just techniques that you may choose to steal. That's kind of the point, right? And I stole them. This is similar to a dependency property for those that have done workflow or WPF. I'm declaring a static field that contains metadata about my property, and I'm choosing to do that so that I don't have to rely on reflection, both from a performance perspective, but honestly, I'm not sure I always am going to have reflection. You don't have all of it on Silverlight, for instance. So this way I can get at metadata without reflection by registering all of my metadata. I'm using data annotations attributes, which works great everywhere except the phone. Right? That's in fact what I'm working on right now, and I'm not done, is basically replicating enough of data annotations so that this code would compile for the phone. But it does work great on Silverlight and .NET. And so you can say, hey, this is a required property, and its display name is customer name. And then within the property itself, I'm just using helper methods from the base class that understand how to get and set the property, honoring things like authorization rules and business rules and different uses of property changed for data binding and so on and so forth. So I end up at a high enough level of abstraction that I can go across all the platforms. This is the key, right? But a low enough level of abstraction so that a normal developer can look at this and probably not freak out, for lack of a better word. So to actually see this, oops. I hit F5. That was a mistake. Pardon my fumbling finger. There we go. While this is rebuilding now, I don't know why it's running. I thought I was running the Silverlight one. There we go. Now what did I do? I broke something, and I broke it badly. possible that these guys all went to sleep while we were talking. There we go. So, this is my Silverlight UI, and so there's some interesting things. This is the object that we were just looking at, the property, in fact, right? And so Silverlight gives us this all by its lonesome self, which is really cool. This is one thing that Silverlight does that WPF doesn't, is this really nice auto-validation stuff. And I can save the object, and it saves, and I get a ID from the database. Not a complicated application, right? Now, the fun part about this is that same exact object that was running on a Silverlight client talking through WCF to an application server can run behind a Windows Forms interface. Doesn't look as nice in a lot of ways. But Windows Forms has the error provider control, so we get the same kind of nice little tooltip because it's in violation, and I can type in a value. I can click save, and now I can see that I got a new ID. Now, the value here, there's no commonality between the Windows Forms UI code and the Silverlight UI code. None. But there's 100% commonality between the business logic, the data access logic, and the database. And that's because of this concept of abstraction at the business object level. But that's not the only level that you might abstract, right? So if we look at that Silverlight code, if we look behind my order edit screen, for example, there's no human-authored code here. The code that you see was authored by Visual Studio as I used the drag-and-drop XAML designer. To me, this is also a goal, is that never, ever, when you're doing XAML, should you have to write code behind. Now, whether that's achievable or not, that's a different debate. But to me, that's a goal, because we know that code behind is a problem. It's a perennial problem. Right? How many people think VB was a great tool? Oh, a few brave souls, right? I'm with you, right? How many people think that the reason VB is so maligned, looked at so negatively, is because developers used it the way it was intended? It was, right? VB was created as a rad product, drag and drop, double click on a button, write your code, and you're done, baby, right? How do you create a WPF application in C# today? In Visual Studio 2010, you drag and drop a bunch of stuff on the form, double-click on the button, write your code, and you're done, baby. So C# is evil. Right? Same logic. In fact, I predict that a few years from now, C# will be evil, because all of the VB3, VB4, 5, 6 people are still with us, in fact, probably in this room. Right? And work with us or for us. And an awful lot of them are still using data sets and are still dragging and dropping and creating VB3 form applications using C# and WPF. Welcome to the future. Right? Now, I say this kind of as a joke, but also as a biting commentary that as architects and as visionaries or whatever we want to think of ourselves as, we have consistently failed because we come up with these complicated abstractions and we can't bring everybody else with. So they just keep using what works. So back to this, my contention is that it's possible to have no code behind, or at least no human written code behind. And the way you do that is using MVVM or MVC or MVP, right? But doing it in a way that's very abstract. And so what I do have is I've got an order view model. And my order view model, you can see, is inheriting from a base class that does some nice work for me. Because after all, this is Silverlight. So there's a bunch of asynchronous work to talk to servers. There's callbacks. There's a bunch of goo that I don't want a normal developer to have to deal with on a regular basis. So my view model base class does most of the asynchronous stuff. And ultimately, I say that I would like you to go get a new order. And I'm either going to get an error, or I'm going to get a result, right? I guess I'm only handling the error case because the result case binds back into the UI. And then I say, well, and I need to be able to show this error. And so, of course, one way that you might think you might show an error is message box dot show whatever. The problem with calling message box dot show is how well does this work on my test server? You know, the headless one that's running my automated tests? Oh, yeah, not at all. So I have some abstraction layer at the UI level where I can say that I would like my shell instance to show an error. Now, this is like, well, in fact, literally, BXF stands for Basic XAML Framework. The intent here is to have the most basic, simplistic XAML framework I could come up with. So it knows how to do three things: show views, show errors, and show status. Right? Useful? Yeah. But certainly as a teaching tool, it is. The point being that this is abstract, so at runtime, show error probably really does show a message box. And at test time, show error just records the fact that we tried to show an error, so that my unit test can establish that we tried to do the right thing. Same with show view. At runtime, it actually shows a view. At test time, it records that we tried to show a view, so that my unit test can establish that we tried to do the right thing. In this regard, it's not very much different from the way that controllers and views work in ASP MVC. In fact, speaking of, well, I don't want to go there yet. So, Silverlight, let's look at WPF UI. My WPF UI also has an order view model. Oh, look, it's almost the same code. In fact, the only difference is that Silverlight, or the WPF data grid, can do add new items, and the Silverlight data grid can't. So my Silverlight view model has to have an add new method. Or let's look at Windows Phone, because Windows Phone is all XAML-based. Oh, look, there's my Windows Phone view model. And in fact, if I run this, just because it's you know, Windows phones are trendy. You can tell that this is not a particularly well-polished interface yet, but hey, you know, and I can click save, and it saves the object. So what I've got here is a situation where I've got the same database, the same data access layer, the same business objects, and at least across the XAML space, almost the same view model code. So I've been able to reuse all these assets. Now, I'm running out of time, and you guys want to have lunch, dinner, food. So I'm going to skip forward to one more thing that I think is really an important topic. Let's see. Actually, I'm going to skip all the way to this, because testing is critical, right? Whether you test first or test during, but regardless, coming up with tests is absolutely critical. And if you're going to be cross-platform, the first thing you discover is that you don't want to maintain tests for every platform. Right? I mean, earlier today, somebody pointed out that tests are part of your code base. Duh. Right? You have to maintain them. And so if I'm going to have .NET code and Silverlight code, Windows Phone code, do I really want to maintain my tests three times? Because maintaining tests is not trivial. And the answer is no. And so what I'll show you is what we're doing for CSLA. And because CSLA is, in fact, a code base that runs across all of these. There we go. So the CSLA tests themselves, of course, are used to run in NUnit. And now they're running, and you can see them all busily running down here. And they don't all pass at the moment, because this is my work-in-progress version. But they're all running an MS test. In fact, this was our first big deal. We wrote them using NUnit years ago, and I wanted them to work in MS test, and so we had to come up with some abstractions between the two to bridge so that the same tests just work in both NUnit or MS test. So far, so good. Let's make that stop. So I've got tests that work there. And then I've got tests that run in Silverlight. And in the interest of time, though, I'll just skip all the way to tests that run in the phone. The same tests. This is really the key. And so I can run, you know, for instance, some of the tests, and running in the phone is an interesting experience. But they all pass. Like, oh, I'm running in the debugger is the problem. But the point being that I have the exact same test code. So how did we pull this off? Well, there is no common testing framework across .NET and the phone and Silverlight. Or at least there wasn't when we started. There is now. There's actually a couple. Right? Microsoft's test framework is similar across the three. NUnit now runs across the three. But then there's this other challenge that we ran into, which is sync versus async. See, here he comes to kick me off. We needed a way to have asynchronous tests that were the same on .NET, that were the same on Silverlight, and the same on the phone. And so we ended up creating something called unit-driven, which we put out on CodePlex. And unit-driven is a add-in DLL for NUnit or MS Test that adds our consistent async testing pattern, and it's an actual runner for the phone and for Silverlight. And ultimately, and you know, I'm not saying that you have to use unit-driven, I'm saying that this concept holds true in that what you need to do is abstract your test framework enough that the same exact test code can run across all three platforms. So with that, I will wrap this up and suggest that in order to get across platforms, you have to come up with abstraction layers primarily at the boundary points. Right? The data binding issues you have to abstract away. How you talk to your data access layer, whether it be two-tier, three-tier, service-oriented, that has to be abstracted away. Using complex technologies like WCF have to be abstracted away. And I would suggest that using complex patterns like MVVM should be abstracted away, so that people just create views, view models, models, controllers, right? And they don't think about how they're wired together, because that stuff just happens. Right? This is where we hit the point of success, where people that are leading the way, which I hope most of you are in that position. So as people that are leading the way, we come up with these really cool answers, and then we abstract them to be simple enough that the rank and file developer can actually consume them and use them. And our abstractions help future-proof things, because I can change my abstraction to give you the same interface experience on the phone, right? The same API on the phone as I give you on .NET, even if they do completely different things. So the things that I've shown you, and actually I forgot unit-driven on here, but you can go get CSLA4 and the sample code from my website. You can go get BXF, which is that simplistic XAML UI framework, from CodePlex, and unitdriven.codeplex.com is the other tool that I was talking about, which is an abstraction for unit testing across the three. And with that, you all can go to lunch. Thank you.